Hi, everybody. I'm Julie, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Julie.
They told me it was a short opening, and that was short. It still surprised me. My sobriety date is August 20th, 2006, and I'm a member of the group of Jaywalkers in Richmond, Virginia, and we meet on Tuesday night and Friday night. We have speaker meetings on Tuesday, and Friday's an open discussion and then a closed discussion meeting if anybody wants to come visit. Let's see what it was like. See, I grew up in a small town in Clarksburg, West Virginia, for part of my life anyway. And, you know, that part of my life was pretty okay. We had, my great-grandfather was county clerk of the courts, and my uncle, my dad's brother, was a big deal lawyer there, so I kind of grew up hanging around the courthouse when I was a little kid. You know, I knew what the jails looked like and those sorts of things. And, you know, that was kind of fun. I remember back then they used to have those great big gigantic printer machines, and they used to lift us up and we'd put our hands on the printer and it'd, you know, make a picture of our hands when we were little, stuff like that. So I learned a lot about the courthouse when I was a little kid. My great-grandfather was an alcoholic. He was one of those binge drinkers, and I only got to see that like one time when I was little. My mom kept that pretty well hidden because she was she grew up with her grandparents, and so she was like in a home of child alcoholic and good at cleaning up after alcoholics and hiding things and keeping secrets. Pretty much during that time, my parents, you know, did drink occasionally socially. I remember Stroh's beer from one beer lover to another. That's what my dad drank. I can't sing the song because I don't sing well, but I do remember that, popping the tops. And every now and then, my dad would give me a sip of beer. And I remember I liked the taste. And that's about as much as I remember about that time. When I was about 9, we packed up everything and moved to North Carolina. My great-grandparents passed away, and my parents gave my dog away, and boom, we were gone. So everything that I knew and was, you know, felt secure and safe with and all those things was just gone. And that's, like, one of my first memories of feeling fearful and not knowing where I belong because I, you know, living there, you know, as a well-known family or whatever, and we just had our little niche there, and it felt safe and secure. So it felt like I was just thrown out in the big, ugly world when we moved away. There was no security. And my parents got a little, crazy around that time. My dad started traveling a lot, and they'd come back and forth, and they'd have, you know, some parties and stuff. They started having a liquor cabinet and things like that. I never really got into it, but, you know, there was a lot of people around that definitely did a lot of drinking. I was around a lot of that during that period of my life. And I know my mom was real unhappy with the way that they were living. And so my dad's boss decided to move to Yankton, South Dakota. And he decided to take my father with him. And so the next thing I know, I was in Yankton, South Dakota. And I don't know, I used to watch Johnny Carson, and I remember one night we were watching Johnny Carson, and I was young, and he was talking, and he was from around that area. And He was talking about Yankton, South Dakota. It has the highest alcohol consumption per capita than any other town in the United States. And I learned that that was the truth. I went to high school there, and during that period of my life, my parents' Friday night family night out was at the Elks Club. The grown-ups sat at the bar and got drunk, and we went upstairs and played pool. And that was family night. So things were getting a little crazy. It seems like they were dragging me to, little nightclubs, and everybody was going out and places like that and stuff, and some strange things happened. Probably about the age of 17, I had my first real drink. It was New Year's, and by then, actually, we hopped over and moved to Kansas for a little while, and my dad liked geographical cures, I ended up liking them a lot, too, but anyway, we're always going to new places and starting new schools and trying to meet new people. And I saw a lot of neat things, Mount Rushmore and all the Wild West and all those type of things. Some tornadoes in Kansas, and they have them in the out there in South Dakota too. You can just watch them go. It's so flat, you can just watch them go and take things out and hop up and down. And sometimes it would rain on one side of the highway and be dry on the other. It just stopped there. So it was kind of neat. But anyway, so we came back to visit Yankton because he was thinking about moving back there. And it was New Year's Eve, and I was stayed at a friend's house. And I'd never really drank other than the sips of Stroh's beer. They decided they were going to take me out, and then nobody'd ever seen me drink, so they were going to give me, some beer. We were going to play quarters, so we did, and I drank a few little cups and started to feel it. And my one friend told the other friend, she doesn't drink, so don't give her any more to drink. This one friend of mine, she really wanted to see me drunk, so she stuck some vodka in my Orange Crush. And I was really thirsty and drank it on down. Next thing you know, I was really feeling it. But, I didn't know it at the time, but when I look back, I realized that, that was the beginnings of alcoholism, because as soon as I got enough in me to really feel it, then we went over to the Lazy D Saloon, and I wanted more, so, people started buying me more. And all that I can remember from that night was just the last thing I remember was throwing up. I did a lot of throwing up. and I don't remember anything else, but apparently, I threw up on another friend of mine's mother's new white carpet and a lot of other things. I've never seen those people since and moved away. And don't know if I'll ever go back there, but I probably own them in men's if I could find them. And they took me, we went to my friend's house, and she took me home to her house and kind of took care of me that night or whatever. And that was my first drinking experience, first real drinking experience. After that, I kind of left it alone. I'm sure I had alcohol poisoning. I was sick for days. So I kind of left it alone there for a while. And I didn't really try. I had some experiences maybe a year later where I'd have a drink, but I was real careful because I remembered that experience. But what happened was I got married at the age of 18 for no particular reason. this guy started hanging. My parents decided to join them. My mom didn't like the way they were living, so she thought religion would help that. when I was about 13. And she came home one day and she said, "We're not having Christmas anymore or any holidays, and this is your last birthday and all this stuff." And she kind of turned Jehovah's Witness is what she turned at that point in time. And so everything started to change, and we started going to this church, and she started dragging me out to my friends' houses to knock on doors, you know, to talk to them about the Bible. And for me, that was like, you know, kind of a shock to my system, because I kind of grew up heathen before that, you know. And, you know, they smoked and they partied and whatever, and then all of a sudden, culture shock, you know. So, so that was kind of tough then. So I kind of bucked that, and you were supposed to wear dresses and things, and I'd wear hiking boots and jeans to church, and it's, you know, real formal type church thing. So I was rebellious about that at the time. And then, so we continued to go there and stuff, and I didn't really do a whole lot. I went, you know, every now and then I'd go to a little party at school, and I was really into sports growing up, so I kind of got obsessed with that a lot for a while, and I would run track, play tennis, do all those things, and like in the sixth grade, I went to the Junior Olympics, and I got like a second place and a third place, so I quit. Because, you know, if I didn't get first place, then, you know, I wasn't good enough, and I had to quit. And I had that feeling a lot from early childhood that I was just never good enough. Nothing was ever enough for me, no matter how hard I pushed. You know, I could get 10 first, but if I got a second, then I was done. You know, I needed to quit because I wasn't the best. And, you know, I did that with tennis, I did that with swimming, I did that with track, you know, and then I'd start up again, you know, in a new town or whatever, and I might be good there, somebody beat me, then I'd want to quit. And I remember when I was 17, that was the first coach I ever had that wouldn't let me quit, and I hated her. Because I had to go out there and I had to lose sometimes, and I didn't like that. So, you know, I kind of had that little ego going on. If I couldn't be number one, then I didn't want to do it at all. And that's kind of how I approached life, you know. If I couldn't go out there in life and just, you know, get a job and do the best and move up, you know, in 2 weeks or whatever, then, you know, I just wanted to quit the job. It was just crazy like that. So, you know, I had that disease of mind, body, and spirit before I even took a drink. My thinking and my perception was off ever since I can remember. So, you know, I continued to do those things. But I got married. The guy from the church started coming around, hanging around the house and getting in with my parents, and they thought it'd be a good idea to get married and have somebody take care of me, and he thought it'd be a good idea. And and he said he was going to kill himself if I didn't. So, and I'm one of those... You know, one of those people that does the victim martyr thing, and I thought, you know, that I would be responsible. And then, of course, you know, I wasn't really concerned so much about, you know, what was going on with him or, you know, what was wrong with him, you know, why he would be like that. I was concerned with what people would think of me if I didn't marry him and he did kill himself, you know, and then, you know, they would blame me because, you know, that's how I think sometimes. And, you know, I'm always concerned about what everybody else is thinking or what they'll think, how I'm going to look. And, you know, so I did that and you know, it was pretty miserable for both of us. Things kind of got violent early on, and that's when I started drinking. Really, I just decided one night to, you know, that I wanted out, and I was talking to the church, and they were saying, you know, you can't get a divorce and stuff, and I got mad, and I went to the liquor cabinet, and I was like, well, I'm going to show them. I'm going to go get into his bourbon, and So that was pretty much it for me. I just remember taking that. I filled up a whole orange juice glass full of bourbon, held my nose and drank it, chased it with some Coca-Cola. And then all of a sudden I got that warm feeling in the pit of my stomach and that sense of ease and comfort that we get. You know, and I felt that really strong, and I was like, well, I'm going to be okay now. As long as I can drink, I'll be fine. I can handle anything that's going on as long as I can drink. And that's what I did. And back then we were, you know, and you know, my thinking then was, you know, and for years it was that I drank because of, you know, this situation or that situation. And that's what I thought then. And I, we, you know, worked these jobs, didn't make a whole lot of money because I didn't go to college like I'd planned. And so, you know, then I drank because I was poor. You know, that was a good reason. Well, I don't have any money anyway, and you know, life's lousy anyway, and I'm married to this jerk, and you know, so that's why I drank. And you know, that's what I would tell people, and you know, and I'd stick around, and stay in that, because that's how I thought was, you know, that, you know, I just have to. You know, it never occurred to me that, you know, I could do something different. You know, get up, leave, go to college, do whatever, you know. Probably a normal person probably would have done that. But, you know, it just gave me a good reason to drink. And that's pretty much what it was. So, you know, that's what I continued to do. By the time I was 19 years old, I was drinking every day. As often as and as much as I could, and I blacked out a lot, threw up a lot. Like I said, that was one thing I definitely did when I drank, and then I drank more. And by the time I guess my mom and dad decided they were moving to Richmond, and I wanted to go with them, so. The husband and I came along, and we stayed with them for a while. And I continued to drink, and things got crazy. And, you know, my family, you know, it made my family crazy, too. You know, so my mom was cleaning up after another drunk. And they decided to leave, and they moved somewhere else, so, you know, we were still here. And I continued to drink, and every day. And I'd leave jobs, you know. It's like if I thought it was gonna catch up with me at one job, then, you know, I'd change jobs. I changed jobs a lot, done a lot of different things. And what happened by the time I was 21, I got put in Westbrook for, you know, nervous and mental disorders in the mental hospital, and depression and all that stuff. But, you know, I didn't tell them how much I drank or anything like that because, you know, I don't tell the truth about those things. So I kind of went in and out of there a couple of times. And I would try to stop, and I showed up every now and then at maybe this one AA meeting a week. And, of course, you know, and that's about all I did. And, of course, you know, I couldn't stay sober. And so I drank again, and I ended up at the age of 21 in one of the big hospitals there in the city. One night I had been hoarding all these pills because, you know, I started seeing psychiatrists and therapists, and all these people were going to fix me. And so I, they gave me pills, and I hoarded all those, and I drank, you know, a pint of vodka and about 10 bottles of pills because I wanted to die. I couldn't stop drinking. I didn't want to live the way I was living. And so I ended up in cardiac arrest in one of the hospitals there in the city at the age of 21. What happened was they stuck me in another one of those treatment centers for a couple of months. I didn't drink for a year and a half. After that, I went to, you know, maybe one AA meeting a week. Got a divorce, lost a baby. And I was going crazy and, you know, dry. My life was getting crazier and crazier, and there was more and more depression and lots of psychiatrists and therapists. And nothing was fixing me. I never, you know, if I didn't go enough or whatever to AA, I just never hooked up with a sponsor. Never heard anything about the steps. I knew that there was such a thing as a big book, but that was about all I'd heard about it, that there was one. But about a year and a half after, you know, after that incident, I was just sitting there one night, and I decided that I wanted to drink, and I was at a friend of mine's convenient store that they owned, and I just went in there and got a can of beer and drank for no particular reason. You know, the thought crossed my mind, that mental obsession that we suffer from. You know, what happened then was, you know, I ended up in another mental hospital. And for a long time, you know, my family believed, and I believed, that I was just mentally ill. I really didn't, still did not understand that I was an alcoholic. It didn't, you know, didn't even, and at that age I thought, you know, I really can't be, you know, it's just all this stuff in my life, you know, all this stuff that's going on in my life, you know, I can't be an alcoholic, you know, people drink too much sometimes in their lives, and, you know, but I'm just crazy. And that's what I believed, and all the thinking, and, you know, and I started doing crazy things, hanging out in the bars, and just, you know, with, and I'd hang out with people who drank as much as I did, or more than I did most of the time, because then I could compare myself, well, you know, I don't drink as bad as they do. But every time I do, I end up in a mental institution or having a suicide attempt. Because I wasn't like one of those, you know, fun, happy, I didn't have a good time drunk. You know, I was miserable, depressed, go crazy, you know, call hotlines, I'm going to kill myself drunk. And, you know, I'd get in blackouts and call, you know, the mental health or whatever, somebody, you know, crisis hotline, you know, I want to kill myself. I didn't remember it. And then the worst thing about that was I would try to in blackouts. And I'd wake up in the hospital and I wouldn't even know that I'd done it. And you know, my life got crazier and crazier and crazier. And I, you know, I'd just hook up with people that were just as crazy as I was, if not crazier. Most of the time, crazier, just violent. People that, you know, some of them are in prisons now, and some of them are dead. You know, they killed people and stuff, and I was lucky that I didn't get killed. And I would just hang out there because, you know, I could get booze, and they were doing other things, so they didn't mind supplying the booze. And as long as I didn't, you know, bother their other things, then I could get my, you know, the alcohol was, you know, supplied. And, you know, I got drunk and got married again. to somebody that, you know, I didn't really know. And some really serious things happened. And, you know, some people in that family are in prison now, too. But out of that, I ended up getting pregnant. And I chose to have the children. Went to spend some time in a shelter and got out of the situation that I was in and dried up again for a while. And I thought that was going to fix me, that, you know, having those kids was going to fix me. You know, so as soon as I found out I was pregnant, well, number one, I was sick the whole time, so drinking wasn't involved in that. You know, so I wasn't drinking, I wasn't smoking. I thought, well, you know, I got everything under control now. And so I went back to stay at home with my parents. And I thought, you know, my life's going to be okay now. And one of my sons, I had twins. One of them was born with something wrong with his jaw where he didn't have joints. They don't really know what happened. They thought it was some kind of genetic thing, something with his dad's side of the family. They had something. Anyway, I stayed dry for probably about a year and a half because I was taking care of him and doing stuff with him and taking care of them. And we went on a family vacation, and I got a resentment because we were in this condo with all these glass tables and all this stuff, and nobody remembered to bring the gates, and I was chasing two-year-olds all around while everybody else was running around in Disney World having a good time. So when everybody went to sleep one night, I had a resentment and went out to the little outside bar there. And I was off and running again, because I drank over resentments most of the time, and you know, and then also when I was feeling good, or just, you know, when the alarm clock went up off in the morning and I woke up, if I was awake, you know, it was a good time to drink. And I did a lot of crazy things, and you know, and hurt the people that loved me the most. I mean, I drank on a bunch of pills that the psychiatrist gave me one time and ended up down in MCV thinking I was Jesus Christ. I think, you know, if you drink on antipsychotics, it make you psychotic, just in case you want to know. And my brother's a funny guy, and he came in there, and, you know, they have all these little emergency rooms in there, and they didn't know which one I was in, so he just went up to the lady and asked her, he said, you know, which emergency room is for people who think they're Jesus Christ? Well, that would be the lock-up psych ward, so, you know. They sent me over there, and they ended up giving me shock treatment 6 times behind that, because they thought I was just some psychotic person, you know, and I still wasn't going to tell you, you know, that I drank, how much I drank, and, you know, that I drank on all the pills you gave me. Because, you know, that's just too honest. You know, and I suffered the consequences of that because they did things to me that probably didn't need to be done. But anyway, I had, you know, these boys I drank that night. I was off and running again. I ended up, you know, had some consequences, stopped again. And I was really good at stopping, but I couldn't stay stopped. You know, I'd stopped several times but couldn't stay stopped. And I'd visit Alcoholics Anonymous and sit in the back row. And just, you know, listen a little bit to it. And I kind of hung out in those meetings where, you know, especially sometimes you can go to these women groups and they just sit and talk about their problems with their boyfriends and stuff like that. And I hung out in those meetings. There was a lot of meetings where everybody was sitting around talking about their problems. I never heard a whole lot about the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, or anything about the steps. But what happened was, you know, after I had some consequences, I stopped for a while, and I started, you know, dropping in at this meeting called Jaywalkers there in Richmond. And this was about 5 years ago. And I asked this lady to help me, and when we started talking about the second step and the third step, and then we talked about writing inventory, I stopped. And I went out and got drunk and found a relationship and did the same thing I always do. Drink, found somebody to drink with, and you know, and I always, you know, looked for, you know, the violent type of people. I don't know what that was about, but that's how it always ended up. And but I had my kids with me this time. And what happened was, you know, things started getting bad. And so I sent my children to my parents. And I ended up, you know, I was taking you know, still seeing the psychiatrist and wanting them to fix me, you know. And I did not, when Alcoholics Anonymous was the last place I wanted to go, because I dropped in and I didn't think y'all could help me. And I didn't really know what it was about. So I had just been, you know, taking outside issues and drinking and working. I ended up with a stress fracture and some problems with my foot. And, you know, I went to the doctor one day and they put me in a cast, to my surprise. So I knew I couldn't take care of my kids. I sent them to my parents. So I didn't have a job anymore. You know, I was living with another alcoholic. My drinking really started taking off again morning, noon, and night because, you know, I didn't have anything to do but sit in a chair and watch TV and drink. The kids, you know, I'd sent them away because I couldn't take care of them. And I was depressed, and I decided that, you know, I was going to drink myself to death. You know, with this person, and, you know, they were drinking plenty too, so it really didn't matter. But things got crazy and things got violent one night, and I made a phone call to this lady where I'd visited a church a couple times, and she knows about AA. And, you know, she just told me, what you need to do is just get up and leave. And, you know, that just thought never occurred to me. You know, and I've done this over and over again. I'd always end up somehow leaving or getting out somehow, but, you know, to actually just think about, well, you know, I could leave. Because my way of leaving was, you know, just to die, drink myself to death, drink or die. And that was my solution to life and life's problems. And I lived basically, you know, to get out of this world. I didn't want to be in it because I didn't know how to live. And it was big and it was scary and people were mean. And, you know, I had no idea it had anything to do with my choices. But what happened was, you know, she put the idea in my head, so I got up and I left. I ended up going to these couple of these guys that I sort of knew, acquaintances, and gave them some money, and they let me stay in their house. And I was just drinking with them one night, and, you know, and whatever happened, I just looked around and I was thought, you know, I don't want to live like this anymore. And I didn't even want to drink myself to death anymore. I just wanted to go out, you know, I was down in the city, go out, buy a gun, and shoot myself. But whatever happened, I poured out the rest of the drink I had and went upstairs and laid there for 3 days praying, you know, for the strength to either kill myself or just, I kind of wanted God to kill me in my sleep because, you know, I'd like to give him directions and I thought it would be better that way. And, you know, because, you know, then, you know, that I don't have to take responsibility and I don't like taking responsibility for anything. So, and I thought, well, you hate me and you've given me this life anyway, so, you know, you should just kill me. And what happened was I remembered the number to a friend of mine in Alcoholics Anonymous in the middle of praying to die. And I had, that person had tried to sponsor me for a short period of time, 5 years previous to today, to now. And I wasn't ready. But over the period of 4 years, I would call her occasionally. You know, maybe once a month. And I watched, you know, would listen to her, and sometimes I would go do some things for her, like watch her dog or help out, and she would talk to me. And she was always kind to me. And she would always listen, and occasionally she'd ask me a few questions. And so I thought, you know, I was really mad because I got that number, and, I really didn't want to go back to Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't realize that I was never really in it, but, you know. So I waited 3 days. But I didn't drink. I just started, coming off anything. And I'd been on a lot of medications, too. About 5 different medications that the psychiatrist had given me. So I wasn't well. And so anyway, I called the number, and I was like, I'm just going to call and just feel her out. And what I did was I called up, and I was like, could you pick me up and take me to a meeting? And I never thought I'd say such a thing, but I did. And I knew where I wanted to go, and she was a member of Jaywalkers. And I'd seen her life change since she started going there. And I watched her change. And I didn't know what it was she was doing, but whatever it was, I wanted to do it too. And so I called her up, and I asked her to take me to a meeting. And so I went back there. And I remember when I got here at this point, I hated myself. I hated all of you. I hated everybody. I was terrified. I was paranoid. I was incoherent. I couldn't hold a conversation with you. I couldn't let you anywhere near me. I didn't want to be touched. I didn't like the whole hugging thing anymore. So I would tell people that there's nowhere in the big book that it says I have to be hugged. And because I was crazy by the time I was literally, nuts by the time that I, hit my bottom. It talks in the big book about being beaten into a state of reasonableness. Well, I had to, be beaten by alcohol for over a 20-year period of time in order to be able to come here and do what you do. And what happened, was I got there crazy in a cast with the clothes on my back, because that's all I had was some pair of shorts and a T-shirt, and was living, practically on the street if these guys wouldn't have let me come in there. And I'd lost everything, and that's all I had, except I did have my vehicle. But I couldn't drive it because I was in a cast, so it didn't matter. So she picked me up, and she kept picking me up and started meeting with me, and we started going through the book. And I was open to that at that point, which I'd never been before. And there was nothing in my system anymore. And I knew relationships weren't going to fix me anymore. Psychiatrists and therapists weren't going to fix me. I'd tried that over and over and over and time again. I'd tried church and religion. And I really, one of the things that didn't happen for me was I never got the second step. I had such a block as far as God went, that I couldn't even hear the word for years. I couldn't hear the word. But at this point, I could hear it because I knew that there was no other solution. That I had to believe in something greater than myself. And a power that was out there that could help me, because I'd exhausted all possibilities. All human power, all everything. Everything that I thought could help me other than that. Because I'd gotten a real resentment with the whole religion change thing and stuff. And I got a resentment there and the things that happened there. And so I got a resentment for God. I blamed all that on God and some other things that happened in my life. And so we read the first part of the book, the doctor's opinion, everything about the first step. And there was no question, she asked me, how's your finances? Well, they're worse than they've ever been. How are your personal relationships? I have none. They all hate me. My family didn't even want me in their house. And how about work? Well, I can't hold down a job. I can't even have a conversation. I can't even talk to people. I can't do it. I mean, most of the time I just sat there and I was terrified. And like I said, I was terrified and I was paranoid, and all y'all had some kind of motive. You were going to do something to me. I just knew it. And it wasn't going to be good. So I stayed away from people, and I worked with her, and I trusted her a little bit, and I was willing to trust, this one person a little bit, because over 4 years she'd never done anything to hurt me. And I was open to trusting God just a little bit. And so that was a start, and that's what she told me. And so we got to work. And she had me write out the second step just what I believed. And what I didn't even realize that what I believed was, I believed that, that God had abandoned me. And all of us really just left me to wander aimlessly and suffer and die. And as I was writing that and coming out of it, I realized, that it was me who abandoned God, and I was wandering aimlessly and suffering and dying from alcoholism. And I wasn't crazy. I'm an alcoholic, which we are all a little crazy, but, it's because we're alcoholics, and we think and act differently, or, think and perceive things differently than other normal people. And we definitely drink differently. So, I kind of had that spiritual awakening there that, it wasn't God, it was me. And, then we went on to, step three. And I didn't really have to think about it anymore when it says, you're willing to turn all this, give all this over to your higher power and stuff. Because, I had nowhere left to go. And so we did that and then got into the fourth step. And I really didn't like that. I had 275 resentments by the time I was finished. I was very blocked. that was a lot of writing time, but I had nothing else to do because I was unemployable. I had no family, no friends. Nobody wanted to have anything to do with me, so why not write? So that's what I did, and I'd call people, and it's like, I want to kill myself. And this one friend says, she's like, well, Julie, you always want to kill yourself, and you just do it without even thinking about it. So I got mad and hung up, kept writing, and then I I'd call, well, I don't like this, I don't want to do it, why can't I just, talk about it? And I had a really hard time with this stuff. Everybody just got me through it. I'd call all these people and they'd just say, well, why don't you go to somebody else's house and do it? Or why don't you go to the coffee? And eventually I got through it. And I remember, I was almost done. And then it was like, oh, there's one more thing I got to write. We got fear and sex and all this. And that was just too much. So every time I finished one, oh, there's more. So finally I was like, and then I told my sponsor, I said, I feel like I'm dying. And, my sponsor's always, very kind, matter of fact. And she says, well, you are dying to self, Julie. So I got mad and hung up then too. But I didn't like any of that. But that's what was happening to me. I finished that up and then I was afraid to share it, but I did. There was one thing I did leave out, that was probably the most important thing because I was afraid to share that. But we did get through the 275 and a year later I did the other 20. and that was about 2 months ago. and I almost drank because I didn't do that. I got in a lot of pain. And I called somebody up and I was like, I want a drink. Then I called my sponsor and I was like, well, there was this stuff I didn't write about. And she's like, well, maybe. Are you ready? So I did. And I started getting some relief because that's what the inventory process does for me. And I was so afraid of it and thought it was so painful and horrible and whatever. And what it does is it helps me get to the other side. It gets me unblocked from God, from the sunlight of the Spirit. so that I can get free. And I remember saying that to her. I said, well, I'm just going to do it because I realize it's all about getting free. It's not about me, and it's not about, you know, you judging me or any of that stuff. And that's what I was afraid of. And I did. And since that time, you know, and thank God, 6 and 7, God, because, you know, this stuff starts to get removed. And I had finding myself doing some of the same things over again. I didn't understand it, and I realized that I hadn't done some stuff I needed to do. And but what happened after that, during that time, right before that time, my parents were, you know, threatened to take custody of my kids. And this was just like 2.5 months ago. And I'd been sober a year, and I was like, well, this isn't right. So I did that inventory, you know, and added a couple more resentments to it and over that. But, you know, and then I did 6 and 7, 8, and I owed my family some more amends, my children and my parents and my brother. And what happened since that time was the part-time job I had asked me to go full-time last week. And since then, when I started that, I started kind of hanging out at my parents' house because they needed some help. My mom had fallen. And I started doing things like painting my son's room and helping out at the house and doing all this stuff. And last week, my parents asked me if I would come back home. And I told them I had to pray about it. But my dad said, well, that's a good thing. And because I said, well, what about the whole religious thing, you know, because we have such a difference. And they said, well, my dad says, he says, well, you have your spiritual thing with AA and we have our religion. And that was amazing because that's not anything that I'd ever expected to hear, ever, because they believe that their way is the only way and that's it. And I didn't think that they would ever believe anything different from that, but they realized, my dad said, well, you're different, you've changed, and you're not the same person that you've been all your life. And so, and my mom was like, and you're just not so self-centered anymore, you know, and I didn't do any of that, you know, and the steps, and God, you know, did that. And, you know, my sponsor had told me, you know, if I was willing to do the ninth step and make direct amends, that the promises would start to come true in my life. And, you know, after that second set of amends, that's what started happening. And so, you know, they left a key on the, after I told them I'd pray about it, then the next day there was a key on the front table waiting for me. And I hadn't had the key to their house in 5 years. So, you know, that's just what, you know, what this program and God can do. And I didn't think it was ever going to happen for me. I was like, but you don't understand, you know, my situation is different. In my family, it's not just my drinking or whatever. It's their beliefs and all that. And when what happened is that it turned out not to be true. And God does have all power, and he can change the minds and the hearts of anyone. And right when that was going on, my grand sponsor had given me this little angel that said, "Believe when it's beyond reason to believe." You know, because I was really struggling with all this. They're going to take custody. All this stuff's going on. I don't have money for court. You know, I start trying to manage all this stuff. And my son's got to have another surgery. And what are they trying to do, you know? And so that's what I did. And I really found myself, you know, surrendering and depending on God more and more. Because I didn't, again, I had no other choice. There was no place else to go. And that's what happened. Was, you know, I'm moved back in now, and, you know, with my kids every day again, and I even got to chaperone them at the U of R homecoming game yesterday, because the school took them over there, and they asked me to be a chaperone. I've never been asked to chaperone children. They didn't even want me to chaperone my own children for a while, so, you know, it's all the kids from school, too, so, So it's just, it's been amazing so far, and, you know, it's been like a year and a little over 2 months, year and 2 months of sobriety. So I don't know what else is out there. And I've been able to be of service to other people. And I had a friend that's been sick and had surgery, and I've been able to be of service to her and her family. And what I've found is, you know, that it's an honor and a privilege to be able to accompany, you know, other alcoholics through difficult times, and to be of service to them and their families. And it's wonderful. I haven't had a chance. Haven't had a real sponsee. I've started with some people and they, you know, weren't ready. So I haven't had anybody right now to do anything with, but I've certainly been able to be of service to other people and my friends in AA that have needed support and help. And I just pray to you know, whatever God wants for me. So, anyway, that's all I have to share.